So we're going to discuss prayer and spirituality in the thought of Rav Lichtenstein today. You might have thought, just given everything we've studied until now, Rav Lichtenstein was a very intellectual person. That's clear. The focus on Talmud Torah, the PhD in literature, just in general, you look at the way he writes and always considering all the options and weighing them against one another. You might think that that's the egghead professor type. That's someone who's fully in the realm of the intellectual, and spirituality is not quite his thing. But that would be terribly mistaken. So I guess first just I'll say a word about personally how Rav Lichtenstein expressed his spirituality and how he conducted himself in tefillah and prayer. But then we're going to look both at some of what Rav Lichtenstein had to say about prayer and what he had to say about spirituality. There aren't a ton of writings on the topic, but there are a couple of key writings that we'll be considering. So first of all, just if you were, if you ever davened in Shivat HaRetzion, especially on Yamim Noraim or times when the whole yeshiva was there, it was very clear that Rav Lichtenstein was very into the davening, and sometimes his voice would raise. This wasn't someone who was silently sitting in a corner doing their thing. He was clearly very, very moved and very, very much focused on davening. Whether that was pouring out his heart on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, or whether it was really crying very audibly on Tisha B'Av. And it wasn't a show. It was reflective of the deep passion that he felt. Despite all the intellectual sides, Rav Lichtenstein was a very spiritual person. We're going to see in a bit how he defines spirituality, but if you met him, you would see that was a core part of what he stood for. So those are the general comments. We're going to look at one article of his on prayer, and it's titled "Prayer and the Teachings of Rav Soloveitchik." So there may be some things here that are primarily the Rav's idea, but it's clear that these ideas also reflect Rav Lichtenstein's own approach. He seems to have pretty faithfully accepted that part of the tradition and internalized it and even built on it in some ways. So part of this article starts off by raising the question, or a general question, of what the value is of prayer overall. So this Gemara in Shabbos here at the beginning of Source 1, the Gemara teaches, Rava observed Rav Hamnuna drawing out his prayer, having a lengthy prayer. He said, "You're putting aside eternal life and involving yourself with momentary life, because eternal life is Torah study." Now, these were people in yeshiva. Instead of learning Torah, he's spending time on prayer. Prayer focuses on requesting personal needs. And that's physical, that's practical, that's less significant than prayer. That was Rava's position. But Rav Hamnuna explained, prayer has its time, and Torah study has its time. There's a valid place for each, and you need to take that seriously. So Rav Lichtenstein relates that the Rav, and I think it's true for the Rav, it's certainly true for Rav Lichtenstein, his approach was to accept the second opinion, that prayer has its time and Torah study has its time. That even though, there's sort of the temptation to say, we believe in Talmud Torah, that's such a core aspect, that will even sacrifice the time spent on tefillah, that wasn't the way that Volozhin and Brisk conducted themselves. Although they did accept, following the Rambam, that the mitzvah of Torah study is greater than that of prayer, and in fact there are accounts, and maybe we're going to raise this, of the Rav missing tefillah b'tzibur, missing public prayer when it was necessary to take a train from Boston to New York, wherever the case was, to save more time for learning. He would not hesitate to do that, but still, davening tefillah is a core part of his approach, and he's going to elaborate on that.
Are you right that the Rav belonged to the school, or presumably belonged to the school of Ravna, which is the side that says that?
Right. Yes. Sorry. I misspoke. Right. So despite the fact that he's on Rav's side in weighing the two against one another, as I said with the story with missing tefillah when necessary, still the idea of tefillah was a core component. Right, and I think it's possible on that side of things, there were some echoes of that in Rav Lichtenstein, but he was much more a believer of you know, davening mitzvah on a more regular basis, he wouldn't do that. Although when he was sick, they used to organize a meeting at his house on Mondays and Thursdays and Shabbos because there was laning. So there's, which is what the Rav did, the laning, because of the brisker sheet or whatever it is. So there's some echoes of it, but he didn't accept that as fully. Still, the tefillah is a central core aspect of the Rav's belief system, and Rav points to this in a couple of different ways. First of all, he would often teach, he would often give classes relating to tefillah, especially in the early years that he was at YU. And then he also talks about the Rav and how he would conduct himself in the context of prayer. So just a nice quote here towards the bottom of page one. Alongside Torah study, tefillah represented a central and potent ingredient in the Rav's personality and his service of God. Those closest to him remember with admiration not only his brilliant lectures, but also the broken heart filled with longing, which characterized his stance as a servant of God, standing before his master, keep in mind those themes, during the Ilah, and the ecstasy and power during the Shema Kol Chai at the Seder. So that's sort of a general portrait that Rav Lichtenstein paints of the Rav, which I think is partially autobiographical or is true for him as well. And then he's going to focus on certain themes of prayer that the Rav focused on that I think were really part of Rav Lichtenstein's approach as well. Before we get to that, there's actually an article I didn't include on lengthening prayer that you know relates itself to this Gemara of having a lengthy prayer where Rav Lichtenstein seems to come, he basically says, you know, if there's a slow Baal Tefillah, the people should accommodate that. If there's a fast Baal Tefillah, people should be a little understanding. But one of the things he says along the way, he mentions a story about there's some famous Rosh Yeshiva who he doesn't name, who was davening, and his son was davening, and his son had a much longer Shmon Esrei. So he goes over to him, looks at his sitter, says, "Funny, you have the same words in your sitter I have in mine, and yet you took twice as long." And Rosenstein is not at all happy with that approach. I don't know if it was the fact that he was sort of dismissing the long davening or the ego side of it, and how could you daven longer than me? But either way, he very much dismissed that, and you can see at least potentially is a supporter of those who wish to daven longer. This is a good story, though. Upsetting, but still a good story as well. So a few different themes of tefillah that the Rav focused on. So first of all, the emphasis on request, on the bakasha as part of tefillah. The Gemara says there's three different parts of davening, of, let's say, Shmon Esrei. First praise, then a request, and then thanks. Almost a preemptive thanks. And the Rav says the one that's in the middle, and the Gemara implies this too, the one that's in the middle, the bakasha, the request, is the one that's more important. Although there are other approaches to that, some people say, you know, how can your requests be important? Even the Gemara we saw earlier indicates that, right? You're just asking for things for yourself. Isn't that egocentric? But we'll see it from some of the other themes that the Rav really saw that as central. The idea that you're asking God for things, showing your dependence on Him, is a core aspect of tefillah. And that relates to the next two themes. The second one, that tefillah is about standing before a king. Right, that when you're davening, you're not just saying words, but you're actually standing before God. God as the, you know, the King of Heaven or the King of Kings or whatever it is, and you know, this manifests itself in several halachot that you have to be sober when you're davening and you have to be properly dressed. And you know, the Rambam says it should be like you're standing in front of God. The Rav really took that seriously. And then the third aspect is this idea of needing a matir, needing a permission, as it were, in order to daven, which is a surprising idea. Usually we think of prayer as an obligation, right? You have to daven this many times on these days. And but the other side of it, you know, it's not at all obvious that one can pray, if you think about it, especially if prayer is requesting something from God. So there's a little bit of chutzpah there, right? Who are we as mere flesh and blood to request something from God, to demand something from God even? How are we able to do that? So the Rav had this idea that any type of prayer in its own structure you need some permission. Whether that's a pasuk that says you can have a prayer with this many brachas, or whether there's a, you know, other sources that point to that too, like this Gemara in Brachos that says, you know, can a person pray all day long? And the Gemara says, no, you're actually not permitted to pray all day long. What's, you know, you think, like, that could be, that's the most pious thing there is. What could be better? But if there's this idea that prayer needs a matir, you need permission in order to come before God, then that that weakens it. That idea comes through that maybe it's not always permitted to pray. Another theme that Rav Luchzin mentions is this idea the Rav developed more generally of the relation between the Maaseh HaMitzvah and the Kiyum HaMitzvah. That sometimes a mitzvah will have an action and a fulfillment. Sometimes they'll line up completely. We may have discussed this when we talked about Derech HaLimud. Let's say the mitzvah to eat the Karban Pesach. So the action is to eat the Karban Pesach, and the fulfillment is eating the Karban Pesach. But tefillah, it actually doesn't line up perfectly. There's a distinction, because tefillah is considered avodah shevalev, according to the Sifrei, the Rambam, where it's considered worship of the heart. So that fulfillment presumably comes from the heart. Although, you know, the action of the mitzvah, it's hard to say your heart is doing it. It's your mouth. You're saying words. That's the physical action, but the fulfillment is actually internal, is in the heart, or whatever you want to call it, in your mind, however you want to define your terms. So that's an interesting distinction where there's a disjunct between the action and the fulfillment, but tefillah really represents that. A couple of other points of tefillah that the Rav emphasized. This one, I think, Rav Lichtenstein a bit less, is that there's two aspects to tefillah. We have communal prayer and individual prayer, and both of them have some distinctive elements. So individual prayer, if you think about it, it's like, you know, the Rav wrote the book, The Lonely Man of Faith, right? So prayer is very individual in a sense. It's silent. It's just a person standing before God. It's like the flight of the alone to the alone, right? An individual goes to God. God is alone. Is completely different. Completely distinct from everything else. And I'm alone, I guess, coming before God on my own. And that's individual prayer. And at the same time, there's an idea of communal prayer where you're part of the broader community. You're part of the broader Klal Yisrael. You come towards God together. So that's an important concept that comes up in prayer. It comes up more broadly too. The idea of citizenship among the Jewish people. But prayer is a particular place where it comes up. And then finally, one, you could call it a pretty surprising theme that actually connects back to some of the ones we talked about just a minute ago, the idea that in principle, an individual is required to sacrifice themselves to God. But you might say, what does that have to do with prayer? But if prayer is seen as worship and a replacement for sacrifice, so what exactly is the connection between prayer and sacrifice? The argument one can make, as the Rav did, is that you actually are supposed to be sacrificing yourself at some level. Not that Judaism condones human sacrifice in practice. Don't try that at home. But at some level, we owe everything to God, and we should have to sacrifice ourselves. And in prayer, we express our utter dependence on God. That without God, the world wouldn't exist. That's why specifically requesting things from God, the bakashos, are so central. Because it's an admission of our dependence on God, which is what it's really all about, that we're offering ourselves to Him. We're totally dependent on Him for that reason. And that this also connects to a novel interpretation of the Rav, of a machlokes dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban. So the Rambam says that there's a positive command, biblical command, to pray daily. Right? Davening every day, at least once a day, is biblical. The Ramban says that it's only a derabanan. But there is a biblical command of prayer in a time of crisis. So the Rav said, what's this dispute really about? Really, they both agree. They both agree that you only have to pray in a time of crisis. It's just that the Rambam says you have to pray every day because we're continually in a time of crisis. You know, human frailty, human dependence on God is itself a crisis, an ongoing crisis that requires, biblically, prayer every day. So that's a very interesting conception of the Rav, but really it all ties together if you think about all these themes. The fact that it's standing alone before God, and you're vulnerable, you're dependent on God, and you're requesting everything from Him. Those all, you know, it's really a certain understanding of prayer that the Rav developed, and I think Rav Lichtenstein largely accepted in his own view as well. So much for prayer. Yeah.
Is it clear that Rav Lichtenstein bought into the Rav? First of all, every single point here, seemingly not.
No, this, yeah.
It's really like the last.
That Rambam, I'm not aware of him giving an alternate explanation. He certainly has quoted this one, not just in this article, but other times. It's a good question. It's hard, you know, it's difficult. You wanna assume that there's continuity between the teacher and student when you have no conflicting evidence, or at least none that you know of, but you can never know for sure.
You may just not have had like an opinion on the sacrifice.
usually you're confronted with a very strong opinion. You're either going to buy it or not.
There's no question. The Rav raised the possibility that they're actually free.
Right.
And quotes that and says,
right. It's possible he has another explanation. Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm not asserting this should not be seen as a proof. This article should not be seen as proof that he agrees on every point. But in terms of the overview, the general view of things, definitely some of the themes we've seen elsewhere. The idea of dependence on God that we've seen, the idea of standing before God, that's come up in various places. We'll see in the spirituality article, actually, it comes up. Those are some of the core aspects, and you see them elsewhere. That doesn't mean that every detail lines up, for sure. So we'll now move to the article on spirituality, and just the framing of it was an Orthodox Forum on spirituality and divine law. So the article talks about spirituality, but it also talks about it specifically in the context of law, halacha, which, you know, you might say it's sort of an odd pairing, but if you think about it in the context of Jewish history, it makes a lot of sense, because if you think about Hasidim and Misnagdim, so the Hasidic approach is much more spiritualistic. Misnagdim are much more focused on halacha. In many ways, this is what a lot of the breakdown was about. The dispute, you know, Hasidim don't care enough about the halacha, or the Misnagdim aren't spiritual enough. So without getting into these fights, and, that's just to provide a little bit of background, that's partially why this topic was chosen. And again, as I mentioned before, as was often the case, they brought in Rav Lichtenstein to sort of frame things, give the big picture. How should we look at this topic, law and spirituality, defining the terms? So there's some definition, but really a lot of ideology that's in this article. So first of all, and this is often the case in articles of Rav Lichtenstein, I assume you've been seeing this as you read his pieces, that often he'll define the terms. He'll spend a good chunk of time in the article just defining the terms, but it's just about always very helpful for understanding the issue at hand. So spirituality can mean three different things in Rav Lichtenstein's view. First, there's such a thing as a spiritual being. For example, God, not physical at all, is fully spiritual. Or angels or demons and the like are, these things are disputed in Rishonim and whatnot, but they're basically spiritual beings in a slightly different way. And humans, of course, are a combination of physical and spiritual. Some would say, partially animal, partially angel. However you define your terms, and there's a dispute about this, and he mentions it, but there's a nefesh and ruach, or, there's a soul and a spirit that go along with the guf, that go along with the body. So that's one meaning of the word spiritual, and then the question will come up as to what's a person's nature, the nature of humanity. Is it primarily physical? Is it primarily spiritual? Generally, religious people take the side that the spiritual aspect is more important or is somehow more of a core aspect. Certainly religious humanism takes that idea as well. So Rav Lichtenstein, being a religious humanist, has definitely thought about this a lot and wrote about it elsewhere. But the idea is to aspire for spirituality, to transcend mere physical life. So that's one definition of the term spiritual. Right, just spiritual versus physical. And that moves to the second question, which in some sense is a growth out of the first one. The first one being just what is humanity, physical or spiritual, and what beings are spiritual. The second one is how do you conduct yourself? So the idea of conducting oneself to maximize spiritual achievement and not necessarily to give in to physical desires, that's a second definition of spirituality, an attitude of spirituality, to focus on matters of spirit rather than carnal matters, than physical matters. And then the third aspect, which is really the focus of the article, and I think what most people mean when they talk about spirituality, although not exclusively, is the question of activity, spiritual activity, and spiritual experience. Right? How does one experience the world? How does one express oneself in a religious context? And how that relates to spiritual things. So the definition he gives, a spiritual person is one who not only perceives reality as spiritual, but experiences it as such. He is one who relates himself and his situation to the world of pure spirit, transcendental. We're in the middle of page 4. And, at whatever level that is. And that entails both an inner sense, you sort of internally experience the world as spiritual, and also expression that spiritual mode of activity can include dance, song, passion, enthusiasm. That's a spiritual way of acting, which presumably is expressing an internal spiritual feeling, right? You experience the world as spiritual in various ways. That expresses itself with certain activity. And, so there's, Rav Lichtenstein points to sources in Chazal that emphasize the internal and spiritual things, such as Rachmana Liba Bai, God demands the heart, or God wants the heart, God wants us to spiritually feel that we're connecting to Him or whatnot. And based on this, the idea of exuberance, of acting spiritually may stem from that. Especially there's the Rambam in Hilchot Lulav that he quotes. Just quote the first line in translation, rejoicing in the fulfillment of a commandment and in love for God who had prescribed the commandment is a supreme act of divine worship. Right, so, and this is in the context of the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the great celebration in the Mikdash on Sukkot, which, I guess it was sort of like Simchas Torah on steroids without the alcohol or something, I don't know. The Rambam in that context expands on this and says that rejoicing over a mitzvah is a really great thing. So there's all these wonderful sources for spirituality, so, it should be straightforward, shouldn't it? But then there's a bit of a challenge. And this goes to the title, the topic of the article and of the whole forum, which is the relationship between the spirit and the law. As Rav Lichtenstein writes, the spirit is often contrasted with the material, the formal, and the intellectual. Right? Spiritual things are not material, they're not formal, they sort of have their own lack of shape, and not necessarily intellectual, the spirit. But all three of those figure prominently within the halachic order, if you think about it. Halacha deals with material, with physical things. It's a formal system, and it's very much intellectually defined. So you have this conflict in terms of the general attitudes of spirituality and towards halacha that's sort of built in. And that's a challenge. Not only is that a challenge in theory, that's a challenge that's been raised by Christians. They say the Pharisees, which were, in a sense, can be seen as the rabbis of that time, at least the way they're portrayed, as, they're so focused on the letter of the law, they don't think enough about the spirit of the law. That's a critique by Paul. Anytime you hear someone say, the spirit of the law of Judaism is X, you should cringe because, that term is originally part of a polemic against halachic Judaism. But anyway, that critique of Paul against the law is an important one, not because he said it, but because it points to a real tension between the spirit and the law sometimes. There are other tensions. Law is formulated based on the public, the average person, whereas spirituality is personal. Everyone has a different spiritual feeling. So how does one deal with this tension? And if we learned a little bit about Rav Lichtenstein, what's the answer when you have a tension? Is to abandon neither and try to do both. We shall abandon neither the normative nor the experiential pole. To try as best as possible to integrate both, minimize the areas of conflict, maximize the importance of each of them. And that's a large part of the rest of the article points to how one might do that. If that means that there should be an experience of God in a spiritual sense, it shouldn't come at the expense of experiencing God as the ultimate commander. And batel ritzoncha mipnei ritzono, nullifying your will before God's will as a core aspect of how one experiences God, rather than this mystical being that I connect to somehow. But at the same time, it's impossible to forego spirituality, and it needs to be incorporated as well. He's going to talk in several ways about how to do that. Yeah.
This article is on Rav Lichtenstein's view of spirituality.
This is written by Rav Lichtenstein.
Oh, this fine.
With many ellipses because it's six pages, not 30. But yeah. Anything that doesn't have a name on it is written by Rav Lichtenstein. Otherwise, we'll
talk about it. It says,
oh yeah, sorry, the editors of the volume. It's in that volume that they edited, but the article itself is by Rav Lichtenstein. So he says you need to have both. You need to have both law and spirituality. What's the value of spirituality? So he gives a few points. First, it ennobles and purifies human personality. It makes a person more sensitive to things, to spiritual things, more sensitive to God. Brings a person closer to the Ribono Shel Olam and to service of God. That's the idea of Shiviti Hashem V'Nagid Tamid, right? Placing God before oneself constantly, which is how the Shulchan Aruch opens up the Ramah. So that's necessary too. And the question is how to have a proper balance, and not just balance, but to have what he calls reciprocal fructification, to have each one improve the other, and for the spiritual to inform and enrich the material and intellectual. So with the idea that you sort of develop yourself in a spiritual way and see how, and in various ways that can help help strengthen halachic halacha and halachic observance. One example of that is that halachic observance is very much quantitative. Right? How much matzah do you get on Pesach? Well, I'm not going to answer that question. People get very worked up about that, right? How much matzah do you have to eat at the Seder? But whatever it is, it's some shir, it's some quantitative amount. But that's not the feeling, you know, that's not necessarily the way to view it. Okay, I had my X ounces of matzah, I'm done now. The way you ideally should view it is, it's so wonderful, we're eating matzah, this represents the time we left Egypt, I feel like I'm connecting to our experience then. That's what you'd want to feel, although, you know, so although the sheer, the quantitative amount doesn't allow for that experience necessarily. And you need spirituality to complement and to add to the halachic observance in order to feel that qualitative dimension. Similarly, the ideas of Ahava and Yirah, love and fear of God. So technically, there's a mitzvah to do that, right? But that's, you know, that's not quite halacha proper. That's not quite classical halacha. It's some broader, more spiritual type of mitzvah. And that's an important one too. It may even, yeah, according to the Ramban, there's actually a biblical commandment to serve God with all your heart, which basically Rav Lichtenstein understands to mean spirituality. Be a spiritual person. It's a biblical commandment. And especially, you know, the quote, and this will remind us of what he wrote about the Rav, this realization that spirituality pervades our entire existence is the basis of our standing before our master, standing before God, and being brought before God, right? So that reminds you of the Rav about prayer being standing before God. So that's one side of things. Spirituality strengthens halakha, and at the same time, halakha strengthens spirituality. Some, I think, very insightful points here that if you think about it, having a set system, let's say how to do the Seder, or being seasonal, and that's the example he gives as well, if you have a sense of how to say brachas, so you don't need to always think, okay, how should I thank God for this water? Every time, figure out exactly how to do it. That would be a very time-intensive thing, or every year you had to plan a Seder. And some people do this, right? Every year they have a freedom Seder, and then the next year, whatever other theme, whatever. Every year you can have a different theme for your Seder. Some people actually do this, so you can afford to do that if you put a lot of time into it. But you know, if you did that for all mitzvahs, that would be physically impossible. There wouldn't be enough time to thoughtfully plan each mitzvah. So the fact that there's a sort of set action of what to do, there are certain risks associated with it, but it does save time. It does give you a direction, so you don't need to wander around figuring out what your religiosity will look like. And another contribution is that of halacha, the spirituality, is that halacha makes God be everywhere, in a sense. Because anytime, whatever you're doing, there's various mitzvahs you're doing, averas you're avoiding, and that gives you a connection to God and a sense of God, an experience of God at all times. As long as you're keeping the halacha as an awareness that it's coming from God, right? If it's just a set of actions that you're doing that you've been programmed to do, then it doesn't really help at all. It's sort of empty. But if your halachic observance is really a spiritual thing, because you recognize who's behind it, you recognize that God's behind it, then it's very much a positive thing. Still, even with these, you know, this reciprocal fructification, as it were, there's still some challenges in place. There's a few specific challenges that are pointed to, but first a quote from the Rav in Halachic Man. Right, Halachic Man is not the same as Spiritual Man, or Homo Religiosus seems to be something like Spiritual Man. The Rav writes, the Rav writes, is halachic man devoid of the splendor of that raging and tempestuous sacred religious experience that so typifies the ecstatic homo religiosus? Is it possible for halachic man to achieve such emotional exaltation that all his thought and senses ache and pine for the living God? Right, it's a little hard if you're always following halacha to have that free-flowing sense of spirituality. You may have it at times, but that's one of the challenges built into the system. Rav Lichtenstein points to several other challenges. One is that the thirst for the spiritual will lead you to have disdain for what's not spiritual, right? Oh, I had the best tish the other night. I really felt like I was connecting to God. Tefillin isn't doing it for me, so I'm going to stop wearing tefillin. It's some sort of logic like that. Right, if you see that keeping mitzvahs is sort of rote, or for you it's rote, you may just do away with it. Or it may help you increase your spirituality in those mitzvahs. So it's maybe a double-edged sword. It may help, it may hurt. Another danger is in terms of attitudes towards the material. Halacha generally relates to the physical world. We've seen this in the Rishonim before, that it's world-redeeming, right? The physical world is redeemed through halacha. We make meaning of it. We make important things out of it by applying it to our service of God. But you can take that too far and say that really it's not about, you know, spirituality and halacha and following Judaism is not about the physical world. It's about something else. So he quotes remarks attributed to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, where he says, Olotecha ushlamecha, you're burning your various sacrifices, that can only be in the Beis HaMikdash, but aliotecha ushlemutecha can be attained universally. There's no reason to have a Beis HaMikdash because you can achieve spiritual heights without a Beis HaMikdash. And for Avlifazin, this is and for others, he mentions this is deeply problematic because, of course, we want the Beis HaMikdash. This is the full part of the full experience of Judaism is bringing karbanos and saying, oh, we have something better than that. Just living a spiritual life is a challenge. And then a third danger, that sometimes spirituality can be so intense that it will rival normative categories. It'll almost become a competition for halacha, which is not exactly the same as the first thing that on an individual level a person will say, I have spirituality, why do I need mitzvahs? This is more like on a systemic level. That religion or Judaism may become too much about spirituality to the point where halacha recedes in its significance. And then finally, and I think this is maybe the most interesting, you wouldn't expect this in this context, there looms a moral danger. Excessive spirituality, possibly tinged by otherworldliness, may lead to averting one's gaze from mere material suffering. Right? I'm so spiritual, I'm having a spiritual high. You forget about things like, you forget about all sorts of things in the physical world, including, if you forget about your own physical needs, fine. That's between you and yourself. But if you forget about other people's physical needs, that's really criminal or I guess, immoral, as the case may be. So that's a challenge. You wouldn't have expected that. It's supposed to be about halacha versus spirituality. But, Rav Lifshitz would never forsake the moral aspects of things, so he mentions this as well. Still, he says, that's not a reason to discard spirituality. The goal is to make it work. To find the right balance. If someone said, you have to decide either halacha or spirituality, then he writes, if we had to decide between pallid normative observance, right, this empty normative observance with no spirituality, and non-halachic spiritual dynamism, right, or great spirituality without halacha, we would, as commanded beings, unhesitatingly, albeit regretfully, opt for the former. Right, you have no choice. Halacha is commanded. Spirituality is important, but it's not commanded in the same way as halacha. But does anyone imagine that the Ribono Shel Olam confronts us with such a cruel choice? Right? That would really be a shame, to put it lightly, to have a whole halachic world with no spirituality, no meaning, no connection to God behind it. Even if you had to do it, you would do it, but it would be a sort of an empty thing, and that can't possibly be what's wanted of us. So the goal is to find a way to integrate both of them. And that's basically how he concludes. To jump ahead to the end of the essay, he writes that we refuse to believe that we are doomed to choose between arid formalism and unbridled sensibility. Right? Basically between dry halacha and spirituality with no limits. We reject both Leibovitz and Buber, both 20th century philosophers who went in different directions. One, Yeshaya Leibovitz, who said, basically, everything is halacha, there's no meaning, there's no spirituality behind it at all. And Buber, who went in the opposite direction. We reject both of those, we need both, we need to find a way to integrate it. Along the way of that article, and this will touch back on what we saw when we looked at Talmud study, Rav Lichtenstein talks a little bit about what's going on in Israel, and this is about 15 years ago, so what was going on in Israel in the 90s, and has continued since, and maybe even increased in some ways, which is that Neo-Hasidut really took off in Israel, and songfests, midnight dancing, Karlbach, Kabbalat Shabbat are among the hallmarks of this spiritual revival. And Rav Lichtenstein says he thinks it's good overall. There's a positive value here, increasing spirituality. But there are also some major reservations here. Number one is the idea of seeing spirituality as totally external. You know, oh, we're so spiritual, we're dancing and we're singing, and that spirituality, as opposed to a quiet internal spirituality, is a real challenge. And thinking about Rav Lichtenstein himself, he was never with a few exceptions, but generally he wasn't the one jump up and down and shout really loud and sing all the time. It's much more of a quiet internal spirituality. So you can see how he doesn't want that to be lost among, let's say, teenagers or young people, young men, you know, dancing and singing, and that's what spirituality is to the exclusion of everything else. So that's one concern he raises. And then there's concerns about deviating from the local custom. If shul never sang Kabbalah Shabbos and all of a sudden they are, is that okay? But those are smaller concerns. The more critical ones are ones where you really miss out on a core experience of Judaism. So he mentions a few examples of that. One is in a spiritual yeshivat hezder, which I think, if I recall, is Rav Shigar's yeshiva, although it may have been a different one, that the assembled tzibur burst into dance in the midst of Tfilat Yom Kippur. In the middle of Yom Kippur, they just started dancing in the middle, I think it was more than just a little thing. It really took off and took over the day. And so that's not what Yom Kippur is about. It's not Simchas Torah. And the response, they said, well, if it's okay on some days to dance, how could it not be okay on Yom Kippur? To which the answer is, well, that's the point. There's a certain nature to the day of Yom Kippur. And to think that you can just, you know, it's just fungible. You do your Simchas Torah on Yom Kippur, your Yom Kippur on Simchas Torah. That's not how halacha works. Right? You have to base your observance on the halachic calendar, not on your own feelings. That's one example. Another example he says is quasi-mystical interpretations of Gemara and other sources instead of learning as the sources actually say. You sort of project your spiritual understanding onto it, which is, in a sense, can be seen as a perversion of halacha. So that's one set of challenges. And then another one is less about spirituality conflicting with something else and more about just having an improper understanding of one's connection to God, an improper understanding of the nature and degree of adhesion and linkage to the transcendental order. To what degree are we as humans connected to God and the spiritual world? And that people may have been a bit off. Here he actually invokes the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, and the father of the Misnagdim against Hasidism. And says that, you know, the question of man's relation to the Ribono Shel Olam is at issue. So he quotes one line, one passage from Rav Shigar, we'll just read it towards the bottom of page 9. Belief in the halacha, this is in translation, like the belief in the sages in this connection, does not necessarily derive from being sure that these sages were the wisest. Right, saying emunas chachamim, faith in the sages, isn't that I believe they were the wisest. Rather, its source is a kind of intimacy. Torah and Judaism. This is I. My choice of myself is the choice of Torah, of tradition. Right, I choose Torah, that's why I believe in Torah. Not because I actually objectively believe it's true. Not for naught did the sages in so many midrashim express their love of Torah through the metaphor of conjugal life, right, of marital sexual life. This realization, which the sages term the acceptance of the yoke of heaven, Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemayim, affords the possibility of contact with the infinite, in that it is absolute and primal. And this is Rav Shigar, and as you can guess, Rav Lichtenstein didn't take too kindly for it. So he writes, and to think that this exercise in narcissism is to be equated with Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemayim, this idea that since it's me, I choose Judaism, therefore I believe in it, and it's great, and that connects me to God, absolutely rejects that idea. So that's one place where he thinks it goes wrong, right? This focus on self-centeredness, in a sense, right? What he calls narcissism. Because I do it, it's true. That's not what Torah is about. Torah is about the opposite. It's about accepting the yoke of heaven, in the way Rav Lichtenstein understands it. It's the exact opposite of sublimating your own interests and desires to God's will. So that's one thing that he objects to. And then another one, this is, I think, even more surprising. Even 20 years ago, or especially 20 years ago, even more surprising, there was a wedding, and he overheard someone talking to a chatan at a wedding, and he said, you know, the chatan said, oh, I'm so jealous. And he says, actually, you don't have to envy God, because you are He, you're God. Only the part of us that does evil is not God. As for the rest, you are He, right? You're God. And of course, this draws on a Hasidic or Kabbalistic idea of we all have a chelek elokam imah. We all have some divine aspect. Or we're created b'tzelem elokim. We're created in the divine image. But this may have taken it a bit too far. This is blasphemy. Rivlin calls it blasphemy. Was there any connection between the gusto and the blasphemy? No less grievous for being innocent, right? To say a person is God, except when you make mistakes, you're basically God, 90% of the time. That's not quite a mainstream theological position. Let's put it lightly. So that's another objection, that you take too much of a spiritual view, you end up with things like that. And yet he says at the end, overall, there's a lot of positive in the spiritual terms, which is not, usually you read this article, you get the sense, oh, he's totally against Rav Shigar and Neo-Hasidus and all that. Although he says he actually supports it, although there are, albeit there are differences. There are challenges, rather, and pitfalls. So that's a pretty surprising conclusion that he has. Given all the things he's worried about, he still says that he thinks it's a good thing overall. We're not going to go into this in depth, but centrist orthodoxy, a spiritual accounting, which was published, taught and then published, I think, a little bit before the other article it's actually referred to. Rav Lichtenstein also talks about a need to focus on spirituality. It's more difficult nowadays to live a spiritual life because both modernism overall and its focus on the material is anti-spiritual. Even some people who are religious, even on, quote unquote, on the right, sometimes have a sort of empty religious life and don't have deep, passionate conviction or spirituality. And he writes, spirituality is very important. We need to make sure to maintain this within centrism. That's part of the article more broadly, which we're going to get to later this semester, about how centrist orthodoxy really needs a cheshbon nefesh, needs to take account of itself. This is a core thing to think about. Right? The article itself is entitled Centrist Orthodoxy, a Spiritual Accounting. Meaning it's not, among the things to care about when you're accounting for your community, is not just how much Torah are we learning, are we staying observant, how midaktik are we in halacha, but spirituality, do we feel God in our lives? That's an important part of that article, which fits with the importance of this issue